here in Orangeburg. A very special thanks to SCSU President James Clark, Roland Haynes Jr., who runs this auditorium, Ken Davis, Curtis Bradley, and all the other Bulldog staffers who made the broadcast from the MLK Auditorium possible. Special thanks here to our team, to John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Carla Wills, and Libby Rainey. I am Amy Goodman. We'll be broadcasting tonight from 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Check it out at democracynow.org, the first ever forum on environmental justice.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Sojourner Truth Radio at 8. Then at 9, it's Beloved Community. John Shuck speaks with Chris Hedges about his book, America, The Farewell Tour.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Cause Cabaret While They Wait on Saturday, November 9th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Funhouse Lounge in Portland. Cause Cabaret While They Wait will be an evening of performances by various singers, storytellers, comedians, and dancers from the Portland area and will benefit those attempting to legally immigrate to the U.S. The event will host raffles, food and drink, and music and comedy performances. Again, that's Cause Cabaret While They Wait on Saturday, November 9th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Funhouse Lounge, 2432 Southeast 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the screening of Can You Dig This? On Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
To change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. We are the soil.
This plant can die, and it grows back in a bad environment in a city like this. Then for sure I know I can fall and get back up and do the same thing.
I put a carrot in the ground and all hell broke loose.
Again, that's Can You Dig This? On Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. MIT professor of history and author Craig S. Wilder is our guest. How were universities like Harvard, Yale, Rutgers, Brown, the College of William and Mary, and others complicit in maintaining and promoting chattel slavery in the Americas? We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headline.
President Trump lashed out against media reports today that he wanted Attorney General William Barr to hold a press conference to declare he broke no laws during a July phone call in which the president pressured his Ukrainian counterpart to investigate Democrats. Barr reportedly rejected the request. The story was first reported in the Washington Post. Trump tweeted out overnight, quote, "It's totally untrue and just another fake news story with anonymous sources that don't exist." House Democrats are investigating Trump's pressure on Ukraine to investigate political rivals in exchange for aid money that was being withheld from that country. Minnesota Senator and presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar told MSNBC that the request isn't a surprise given Barr's notion of presidential power.
Literally, when Barr applied for this job, he put out a 19-page memo to all of Trump's friends showing how he believed in a broad concept of executive power.
Barr famously held a news conference ahead of the release of special counsel Robert Mueller's report into Russian election meddling, playing down links between the Trump campaign and Russia. A top aide to Vice President Mike Pence is likely to comply with the request to testify on Capitol Hill. Jennifer Williams is an aide to Pence and a longtime State Department staffer. She would be the first person on the vice president's staff to appear before Congress. Her lawyer said she's expected to show up for testimony today if she receives a subpoena. House Democrats have typically issued those subpoenas the morning of a witness's scheduled testimony. Williams was one of the nearly dozen officials listening in on President Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That's according to two sources familiar with the matter. She was concerned about what she heard on the call, but there's no indication Williams raised her concerns to her superiors. Democrats say they have questions about her knowledge of how much Vice President Pence knew about efforts by Trump and those around him to push Ukraine to launch investigations into Joe Biden and his son, as well as 2016 election interference. There's no evidence of wrongdoing of either Biden in Ukraine. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton is also on the schedule, though he's not expected to show up. Iran alleged today that the UN inspector it blocked from a nuclear site last week tested positive for suspected traces of explosive nitrates. The UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, did not immediately comment. The allegation made by Iranian Representative Kazem Gharib Adabi came as Iran injected uranium gas into centrifuges at its underground Fordo nuclear complex early today, taking its most significant step away from its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. These latest steps by Iran put additional pressure on Europe to offer Tehran a way to sell its crude oil abroad, despite the U.S. sanctions imposed on the country since President Trump unilaterally withdrew America from the nuclear deal over a year ago. A Chinese court has sentenced three fentanyl traffickers in a case that was a culmination of a rare collaboration between Chinese and American law enforcement to crack down on global networks that manufacture and distribute lethal synthetic opioids. Liu Yong was sentenced to death with a two-year reprieve, while Zhang Junhua and Wang Fengji were sentenced to life in prison today. Working off a 2017 tip from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Chinese police busted a drug ring based in the northern Chinese city of Jingtai that shipped millions of doses of synthetic drugs to the U.S. and other countries from a gritty clandestine laboratory. U.S. officials say China's vast chemical industry is the main source of illicit fentanyl. Chinese officials deny that. The result of Kentucky's governor's race on Tuesday is still unknown. Republican Governor Matt Bevin said next week's re-canvass of the vote count in the election won't be his last move in challenging the results, which showed him more than 5,000 votes behind Democrat Andy Beshear. Beshear, meanwhile, said he's confident in the election outcome and is focused on taking office as governor in December. And some prominent Kentucky Republicans have begun calling on Beshear to concede. Beshear led by less than 0.4 percentage points in Tuesday night's count of more than 1.4 million votes, which would trigger a recount in most states. Kentucky doesn't have a mandatory recount law, but Secretary of State Allison Lindoragan says she was scheduled to re-canvass 3-2-1. Kentucky doesn't have a mandatory recount law, but Secretary of State Allison Lindoragan Grimes has scheduled a re-canvass for November 14th to ensure the vote count was added correctly. Bevin said late Wednesday in Frankfort that his team is gathering evidence of what he's calling irregularities in the voting. The governor claimed the thousands of absentee ballots may have been illegally counted and suggested that people may have been improperly turned away from the polls. He provided no evidence. California's Attorney General acknowledged an ongoing investigation into Facebook's privacy practices on Wednesday as part of a lawsuit against the social media company over its failure to provide documents and answer questions. And as Christopher Martinez reports, Javier Becerra said his probe has been going on for more than a year.
Becerra says the California Department of Justice has asked Facebook for information about its business practices, including its relationship with the now-defunct Cambridge Analytica, a British company that harvested Facebook data on millions of people, using it for a political disinformation campaign supporting Donald Trump.
Facebook moved slowly in response to our subpoena, taking over a year to respond to a request for documents.
Becerra says the company's response was, in his words, patently insufficient. He says the company provided no answers to 19 of 27 written interrogatories, gave partial answers to 6, and produced no documents. Becerra says the issue was important because it involves personal information about Facebook users that the company then lets third parties harvest. Reporting from the State Attorney General's office in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
We now go to our interview with MIT history professor and author Craig S. Wilder about his book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. Professor Wilder puts together the true story of the hidden interrelationship between the country's most elite universities and colleges and the institution of slavery. Dr. Craig Wilder, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to find out from you what inspired you to get into this particular field, and in particular to do the book that we're going to be discussing today, Race, Slavery, and Troubled History of America's Universities, Ebony and Ivy.
Actually, you know, about more than a decade ago now, I was making a move, professional move, from Williams College, where I'd been teaching, to Dartmouth College. And I had decided to give myself an assignment coming out of my last book project in the Company of Black Men, which studied African influences on early New York and black radicalism and organization in early New York. I was going to explain how black abolitionists, I was going to write an article to explain how black abolitionists got their educations and entered the professions, given the fact that they couldn't go to college. They were excluded from the nation's colleges and universities by those universities' racial bar. And so how do you become a minister, a teacher at the colored school, or a doctor, for that matter, if you can't attend university? And so I was tracing the stories and the journeys of these often teenagers who traveled all over the Northeast looking for schools that would accept them or friendly ministers who would teach them sort of in an apprenticing mode. And I became much more interested in the fact that they had been excluded from the colleges and why the colleges were excluding them. As I traced their journeys and the extraordinary struggle that they had to acquire education, the violence that they met and they confronted as they tried to access education, these sort of mobs that attacked schools that were willing to admit even a single black student, I became much more interested in the nature of education in American society and the role that colleges and universities played in shaping the racial civilization of the United States. I stopped seeing colleges and universities as these sort of passive institutions that sit in the backdrop of history and observe, and I started seeing them as institutions that actively participate in shaping history, in determining who can be educated and who can't. And in sustaining and extending the power dynamics of American society, the status quo of American society.
Yeah, and I noted also that you began as a community organizer in, you know, in your adult life, and a lot of people got involved in community organizing. But historically, just moving to the present for a moment, in the past few decades, there has been a tension between the community and the academy, and people who are based on the academy and accountability to the community. And noticing your work with Bard and other projects, I wondered if you could just say something a bit about balancing that and the interrelationship and the importance of that kind of balance.
You know, I think while I was in college, as you said, I went to Fordham University in the Bronx, and I'm out of Brooklyn, out of Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. When I got to college, part of the way that I came to understand my fortune at being in college, the opportunity that I had, was by looking for opportunities to sort of remain connected to communities like the one I came from. And so right outside the gates of, you know, this sort of Catholic university in the middle of the Bronx was the South Bronx, teeming with all sorts of issues and questions and pressures and dynamics, much like the neighborhood I came from in Brooklyn. And so I used the opportunity while I was in college to do a lot of off-campus work, which then led to a position as a community organizer after I graduated from college, and I spent the next year or so doing organizing in the Bronx. This is the Bronx's burning Bronx. This is the Bronx at what was often perceived as the height of its urban crisis. which is very similar, like the crisis to the crisis that was happening in my own neighborhood in Brooklyn. And so, for me, the relationship between the academic pursuits, the ability to study, read, research, and write for a living, and its connection to the real lived experiences of actual people, has always been central. Like it helps me make the one thing helps me make sense of the other. And being connected to real communities with real issues and struggles has helped me to make sense of my own relationship to the academy, where I'm both an insider and an outsider at times. I'm part of these institutions, but I also, in fact, need to stand apart from them at times as a critic of them, to challenge them, to use their resources in ways that actually do the greatest good for the greatest population of people.
Yeah, well, that is so interesting, and I think very much needed. And I'm sure, as you say, one does inform the other, because we see all too often people get into the academy and kind of are stuck there and don't have a relationship with communities that they came from, or even communities outside of the academy. So I'm sure that you have found in your work that it has actually strengthened your work within the academy itself.
Yeah, and you know, it takes a bit of energy. I mean, I think we tend to reward isolation. The academy is organized in a way that rewards us for isolating ourselves often from the greater population. It rewards us for sort of focusing on the very esoteric realities of our own research writing, and for writing to a quite limited audience of scholars at other institutions like ours. And there aren't a lot of rewards for breaking that isolation. There aren't a lot of incentives to break that isolation and to reach out to broader communities of people. But in my mind, that's exactly the reason why universities exist. You know, they exist to do social good, to do the greatest good to the public. So we have to resist that tendency toward isolation and alienation, because I think it's actually a socially irresponsible incentive.
Yeah, and you say it takes great energy, because, the way things are set up within the academy, I mean, so much of your time and focus is needed, not only to do your work, but also just confronting the issues within the campus itself, the academy itself, having to do with race, for example. I mean, you're a man of African descent, economic divides, et cetera, that it could really take all you've got to get through that, and yet be able to stay connected to community. So
yeah, you can have a full career and never leave your building on one of these campuses, and that doesn't mean that one wouldn't have been engaged in real issues, because they're real issues for our students, issues of the cost of higher education, the experience of students of color on campus, diversity questions, all sorts of questions, gender and sexuality, inclusion and resistance. There are enough political issues on campus to keep one quite busy. But I also think that we have to break the conceit of thinking about ourselves all the time, and actually look at our impact as institutions of higher education on the greater population.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and my guest is Craig Stephen Wilder, has a book out, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And I wanted to start off the discussion in a way with a broader view, and then getting into some specifics. Clearly, the conquering of Native people, stealing the land, getting rich and educated off the slave trade, but also governing a free population with a history of resistance. And in fact, that latter phrase is from within your book itself. So the people in the colonies first coming to the United States, I just want you to talk a little bit about that, because that is really the setup for so much of what happened after they arrived.
There was this really interesting moment as I was doing the research for the book, where I was struggling to understand a phenomena that happened repeatedly in the colonial world. If you think about Virginia, the Virginia colony, Jamestown, is established in 1607. and within a decade, in less than a decade, they've gotten a charter from the a royal charter from the Crown of England to establish a university in Enrico, Virginia. They've been granted 20,000 acres to help support the school. The about 300 people are being sent to basically become tenants on the university grounds, from which the rents from which will actually pay to run the university. And a rector has been assigned, an experienced missionary who had done missionary work in East India, has now been assigned to the Americas, to the Virginia College, Thomas Coleman. But you have this sort of rather odd moment in Virginia at a time when the colonists are actually struggling to feed themselves.
Yeah.
When the death rate in the Virginia colony is extraordinarily high, and when there are very real security issues about for the colonists, they're going to the tremendous expense and expending the energy to raise a college. In New England, the Puritans arrive in Massachusetts in 1630. Within 6 years, they've got a college charter, and they've begun Harvard. And again, at a moment when the colonists are dealing with serious security issues, the death rate is much lower in Massachusetts. But in fact, they have serious security issues. They're going to the expense and they're expending the energy to raise a college. You can also see this in New Spain much earlier when the Spanish invade the Caribbean and what's now Mexico and Peru. You can see it in New France, Eastern Canada, when the French begin their first colonies. Almost immediately, Spanish Catholics, English Protestants, French Catholics begin building colleges. And it forces one to rethink the role of the college in the colonial world. Why are they expending this kind of energy and this kind of money establishing institutions for higher education in places that have not actually dealt with the immediate crises that they're facing, just sustaining themselves? And the answer is actually that the college is part of the apparatus for achieving security. The college allows one to begin the process of evangelizing and missionizing Native American peoples, the surrounding Native nations and tribes. It allows one to begin a process of almost constant cultural warfare in which one extends, one Christianizes the Native population, brings in young Native students into Christian schools for conversion, for language acquisition, for a broad education, and then sends back into Native American communities, as one missionary will put it, people of their own color and blood to continue or to accelerate the process of cultural conversion. So colleges are part of the instrumentality of colonialism. There's a very good reason in that case to build colleges early, because the college allows one to achieve security through mechanisms that don't rely upon military power alone. Those sort of cultural wars are going to be incredibly important to achieving a kind of security and stability for colonies in the Americas.
Right, and also creating wealth as well.
Also creating wealth, yeah.
Yeah, wealth and security.
You know, you can see this at early Harvard. Harvard is established in 1636. The Virginia College, which would have been the first one, is destroyed by a Native American war that breaks out in the early 1620s between the Indians and the Virginians. And so that college never gets established. Harvard's established in 1636. There's a war the very next year in 1637, the Pequot War in southern Connecticut, of the English versus a pan-Indian sort of resistance. It culminates in the Pequot Massacre and the destruction of hundreds of Pequot men. But the hundreds of women and children are also taken captive. That very next year, a ship leaves New England. It's the first slave ship to leave New England. It's carrying Pequot women and children for sale in Bermuda and the West Indies. And it returns in 1638 with various commodities, including black people. Well, Harvard gets two things at that moment. It gets 2,000 acres of Pequot land that's been carved up after the English conquer the Pequot. And so it gets as part of its endowment, 2,000 acres in Connecticut, a former Pequot territory. But it also gets its first slave, a black man who's referred to by the students as the Moor, who's one of the earliest residents of Harvard Yard and the Harvard campus. And so the beginnings of Harvard tie the institution to both the conquest of Native people and the enslavement of Africans. And those connections then grow, in fact, rather quickly over the next several decades.
Yeah, and in fact, you talk about the Indian for African trade or slave right. trade, and yeah. I suppose that was the beginning of it.
That's one of the beginnings of it. Mm-hmm. In the English colonies, that's the early origin of it, and there's a healthy trade in the Carolinas, eventually in Virginia and in New England, in which we exchange conquered native people and captured native people for Africans. The native people often being sold into the West Indies, but also sold into New France, into Eastern Canada, where there's a fairly healthy market for enslaved Indians.
You talk in the book about the first five colleges in the British American colonies, which are Harvard, William and Mary in 1693, Yale 1701, Codrington in 1745 in Barbados, and New Jersey, which is now a Princeton, I think, right?
Right.
And 1746.
The College of New Jersey is now Princeton. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was interesting to me because, you know, of course, being from Barbados and Codrington yeah. happened to be the place my dad did his teacher training at Codrington.
Okay.
I had no, because of course growing up there, right, we weren't taught any of this stuff. So,
right.
you know,
I wasn't
what
either.
We know?
Yeah, I went to one of these colleges and I've taught for, and I've worked for a couple of them, and I knew none of this either until
okay.
the past decade. Yeah.
Yeah. But I wanted you to talk a little bit then about the Caribbean connection here in terms sure. of the interrelationship with the slave trade, because not a lot is known about that either, and Barbados right. being very prominent in it as being one of the wealthiest at the
yeah.
time.
It's actually the wealthiest. The wealthiest possession that the English have in the Americas
yeah.
is Barbados. And as multiple historians of New England and of Harvard will point out, that period I was talking about when the college gets its first slave in right after the Pequot massacre, this is the beginning of the commercial relationship that will save New England. New England emerges in the late 1630s and then through the 1640s and 1650s as the supply center, the provisioning center for a rising economy of plantation slavery in Barbados and the British West Indies, and then ultimately what becomes the mainland, the south of what's now the south of the United States. But New England actually will send ships into the West Indies, supplying the West Indies, Barbados for instance, with everything that it needs to sustain itself, so that almost every inch of that valuable Barbadian soil can be turned over to commodity crop production with the use of slave labor. And the food supply will largely be augmented from the northern mainland. And so New England ships bring everything from vegetables to salted and dried fish to wood to make the barrels that rum is carried in, to candles so that enslaved people can actually work in the evenings in the process of refining and milling sugar into molasses and rum while they work the fields during the daytime. New England will become, in fact, the supplier of the West Indies that helps the West Indies, the British West Indies, sustain this incredibly profitable plantation economy. And by doing so, New England actually manages to emerge as a central sort of site in the merchant and the Atlantic trade, eventually actually extending their trade into supplying the West Indies and the American South with enslaved people too. And so they'll expand into the African slave trade and do, in fact, the whole gamut of supply that sustains plantation slavery and allows it to maintain its extraordinary profitability. The American colleges that are established from Harvard on in the English colonies are in fact part of this economic nexus, and part of their role is actually to supply those colonies with ministers, with officials, and so what one has is this really quite tightly braided world of English colonies connected together both economically, socially, intellectually, and then through their religious and their cultural institutions. We tend to think about the United States today and project back those boundaries on the past, and that doesn't work particularly well. you know, Barbados is central to the fate of New England. New England can't survive without Barbados. The Mid-Atlantic colonies are actually fighting. New York and Pennsylvania, New Jersey, are fighting to break into the trade, into the supply trade to the West Indies, for their own commercial fates. And so before the decades of the American Revolution, one really has to think about the British Atlantic world rather than the 13 colonies that become the United States, because those 13 colonies often have closer and more intimate economic and social ties to the West Indies than they do to each other.
Our guest is Craig Stephen Waldry. He has a fascinating book out entitled Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And he himself is based at MIT. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this, because when I first went to the UK and saw, you know, basically the wealth that the slave labor, those of us in Barbados, created, it was most disconcerting. And also the fact that the British working class didn't really seem to get much of it. The wealth, I mean, the plantocracy, they're still today, by the way, called the plantocracy in Barbados, but the plantocracy were so enormously wealthy, but they also played a huge role. I mean, the trade was going from the colonies to Barbados, but there was a lot of money also coming into these colleges from places like Barbados. Is that right?
Absolutely. In fact, actually, this is the story of Codrington College. Yeah, this is Christopher Codrington, Her Majesty's commander for the West Indian Islands. In the early 18th century, the early 1700s, I believe his final will is around 1710 or 1712, somewhere in there. It leaves in his will a couple of plantations for the support of a college on the island. And it takes, in fact, multiple decades for that college to be established for a lot of reasons. The other planters are very worried about the social effects of establishing a college. There have been a series of slave revolts in Barbados and the British West Indies that lead them to be even more concerned about their ability to control and regulate the colonial population, and particularly the enslaved. Part of the Codrington Grant, and this is sort of, the grant actually leaves plantations and slaves to the Society of the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts in England to support its missions. And it leaves money to Oxford University in England, where Codrington had attended, his alma mater. And then it leaves a fund, a plantation, to support a college on the island. That college isn't established for basically another 30, 35 years. But in fact, actually, one of the things one finds is an extraordinary amount of West Indian wealth being funneled into American colleges. Long before the Codrington Grant was established by Christopher Codrington, Harvard was actually in the West Indies seeking both students and donations. When William and Mary is founded in 1693, the Virginia College depends heavily upon the local planters. It's a planters' college. And so it's very much a regional, local school that uses the local slave wealth to sustain itself. Yale is established 8 years later in 1701, and Yale then begins seeking students and donations well beyond Connecticut's borders, often turning toward the West Indies. By the middle of the 18th century, when all the new colleges are established, the Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, Columbia, Brown, Rutgers, and Dartmouth, between 1746 and 1769, that 23-year period, six new colleges are established on the mainland, meaning that the number of colleges in mainland North America triples from 3 to 9. That's the height of the African slave trade. And these colleges are now aggressively pursuing the West Indians as sources of both money and students. John Witherspoon at Princeton, the president who comes from Scotland to help save this struggling college in 1768, almost immediately writes a missive to the West Indians in which he declares that the very name of a West Indian has come to imply great opulence. He continues to bow before the Jamaicans and the Barbadians and to present Princeton as the logical place for them to send their sons, because wealthy boys from the West Indies will be preyed upon by unscrupulous people if you send them to England's universities. But if you send them up to Princeton, New Jersey, they'll be well taken care of, they'll be carefully attended to, and they'll be churned into good Christian men and sent back to their families as productive citizens.
You're listening to a one-hour discussion with author and historian Craig S. Wilder. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, more about his book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Stay tuned. At 9 a.m., we have Beloved Community. John Shuck speaks with Chris Hedges about his book, America, The Farewell Tour. Now back to more Sojourner Truth Radio.
Well, it ain't that hard when you got soul.
This is my world.
Somewhere I heard that life is a test. I've been through the worst, but I still get my best. God made my mold different from the rest. Then he broke that mold, so I know I'm blessed. Stand up now and face the sun. Won't hide my tail or turn and run. It's time to do what must be done. Be a king when kingdom comes. Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man. Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody.
I'm Elliot Gould, and you're listening to Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott.
Welcome back. This is Sojourner Truth. I'm your host, Margaret Prescott. We will now continue our discussion with MIT professor of history and author Craig S. Wilder about his book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. In your book, you don't leave south of the border out of it. I mean, you talk about what happened in places like Peru and other parts of Latin America and what the Jesuits did, because there is such a relationship also with this kind of religious fervor that you kill the natives and enslave the Africans, right? And with all kinds of justifications.
Yeah, you know, Harvard, the story of Harvard doesn't make sense without the Catholic story. You actually have to, 100 years before Harvard's established, the first college in the Americas is established by Catholic priest in what's now the Dominican Republic, in Santo Domingo. It's the Autonomous University in Santo Domingo. And it's still there. You know, the Dominican Republic to this day has the oldest university in the Americas. It's right there. I'm probably the one person who went to the Dominican Republic and didn't go to the beach. I went to the university. I also went to Barbados and never saw a beach. I went to Codrington College.
It's beautiful.
Hung out on campus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. And wandered around that campus, the entire time. But, 100 years before Harvard in 1536, the Jesuits established a college in Santo Domingo. And the role of the college in Santo Domingo is the conversion of the indigenous population and the supplying of the administrations of this new Spanish empire that's being built in the Americas. In the aftermath of the construction of that school, everywhere that Spain invaded, everywhere that Spain colonized, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, it established universities. And the role of the universities was the conversion of the indigenous population, the codification of indigenous languages, and the universities were sustained by a network of plantations that used enslaved Africans to support the institutions, to generate the wealth that allowed these institutions to carry out their missions. And so the largest slaveholders in Spanish America will actually be the Jesuit priests, the Jesuit order. By the time that they're expelled from the Americas, two centuries later. And so you have, in fact, from the very beginning of European colonialism in the Americas, this very close tie between the establishment of universities, the conquest of native people, and the use of enslaved African labor to support the missions of the university and the processes of conquest.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder. He has a book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of the Americas. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, Dr. Wilder, another sort of myth that there is around has to do with the numbers of people enslaved in the eastern part of the United States, then the colonies. colonies.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I wanted to do with the book was you have to break down, as you described it, a lot of the myths that we have about the nature of slavery in colonial America. Yeah, one of them is this clear distinction that we draw, which is really based upon the later history of the establishment of the United States, between the West Indian colonies and the North American mainland colonies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that myth needs to be shattered. You know, we have to get beyond that, or you never understand, you know, what happens in New England. You can't understand the history of New England without understanding the history of Barbados and Jamaica. And the same thing is true for the Mid-Atlantic. The history of New York is, in fact, intimately tied to the history of the West Indies. Another myth that we have to break down is a myth about where the geography of slavery itself, in which we tend to imagine that the enslaved population is in the West Indies and the American South, and the relationship between the northern colonies and those places is fairly loose. And the way you break down that myth is really by remembering first that the Atlantic slave trade is largely organized through the northern colonies, that the chief slaving port of the Americas is actually Providence, Rhode Island, that Boston, Philadelphia, New York are all in fact competing to enter into that trade and to dominate that trade, and that one of the consequences of this heavy northern involvement in the slave trade is the growth of a population of enslaved black people in the northern colonies themselves, and particularly in these areas surrounding these slave trading ports. You know, and so you find, in fact, in Manhattan, probably, you know, one out of five people at its height is an enslaved African. Mm. In Brooklyn, it's one out of three. And part of the logic of this is actually that Brooklyn, like much of New England, is a largely agricultural society, but much of the agricultural product, the rise of a kind of commercial agriculture, is intended to supply the plantations in the South and in the West Indies. And so there is, in fact, a real use of unfree labor in the northern colonies to help produce the materials that will supply slavery in the southern colonies and the West Indian colonies. And so one of the things I wanted to do in the book was really to show the dramatic rise of the black population in the Americas. And I think it really is easy to forget the sweeping demographic transformation of the Americas that takes place in the centuries after Columbus. I often do this with my students. I think most of my students are ready for the moment because they've taken a lot of United States history and American history, North American history. Most of us are ready for this moment when people of European descent come to outnumber Native Americans. But what they might not be ready for, what we're often not ready for, is the moment when people of African descent come to outnumber Native Americans. And so one of the things I did in the book is I tried to just show the impact of all of this by reminding people that probably as early as, in fact, earlier than 1750, the black population of the 13 seaboard colonies, the 13 colonies that eventually established the United States, before 1750, somewhere before, the black population actually comes to outnumber the entire Native American population east of the Mississippi River. And so one of the ways in which we have to think about the role of the slave trade and the role of slavery in shaping colonial society is that it's funding the constant expansion of the colonies, the constant push into Native American territory, the constant push westward is actually allowed by both the slave trade and the expansion of African slavery. 50 years later, there are likely more black people in the on the Atlantic seaboard of the United States, of the early nation, than there are Native Americans everywhere in what's now the continental United States. You know, these are sweeping demographic transformations, and unless we actually think about them in those terms, you miss a lot about American history.
Our guest is Craig Stephen Walder, Dr. Walder, who is a history professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he has a book out entitled Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. I recall reading not that long ago about this huge slave grave that was found in New York City under what is around Wall Street, and that it was found that a lot of those who were buried there were actually worked to death. They were worked so hard that they literally died from overwork. And one has to keep that level of brutality in mind as well. One of the things that my daughter actually pointed out to me, she says, Mom, you know, I feel as if I was born in another era, that I could have been made into a purse. And that wasn't so far-fetched, because it was the use of African skin as hides to make bags, the way that Holocaust victims, that happened to Holocaust victims in Germany, that were skin was used to make lampshades and various other knickknacks.
Right.
And that has to be part of looking at this, the entire thing as well in relation to the universities.
In fact, actually, mm-hmm. And one of the things I hope I do in the book is really to break down some also yet another body of myths about the nature of slavery in the northern states. And so when we admit that slavery was, you know, that we had slavery in the northern colonies and northern states, we then, in fact, had tended to create another myth about it, that it was somehow gentler and milder and sort of fundamentally at its core, more humane than slavery in the South and the West Indies, the other comparison points. And in fact, actually, if one looks at the nature of slavery on campus, the people who were enslaved on college campuses, Eliezer Wheelock, the founder of Dartmouth College, which is founded in 1769, arrives in New Hampshire with 8 enslaved black people, 7 adults and a child. He's got more slaves than faculty. He's got more slaves than trustees. And in fact, an honest accounting would say that he has more slaves than actual students. The largest population of people on early Dartmouth campus are slaves. Well, Wheelock actually, is in one episode, calls the sheriff onto the campus for the purpose of, basically having beaten one of his slaves, who he thinks has actually stepped beyond the line of good behavior. Here in Boston, one of the presidents of Harvard, Benjamin Wadsworth, had earlier given a sermon while he was a minister in Boston before he took the presidency about the necessity of beating slaves, the biblical imperative to actually beat servants to make sure that they behaved. And he quoted scripture as he instructed his audience that it was their moral duty to inflict physical punishment on the slaves in order to keep them in line. Wadsworth actually had a slave with him while he was the president of Harvard, Titus Wadsworth, who lived right on the Harvard campus in the president's house. And so, the violence that attends slavery also attends slavery in the North, but one can actually extend that. The academy rises by feeding upon the rise of the Atlantic slave trade and African slavery in the Americas. It's a source of both funding of students, of much of the wealth of the colonial college, but also when we begin to build science programs and medical programs, those faculties use the bodies of enslaved people and other marginalized people like Native Americans and sometimes the Irish for instructional purposes. And so at Dartmouth, Eliezer Wheelock, the founder, his personal physician, takes the body of an enslaved black man who just passed and removes the entire skin from it. He then boils this man, Cato. He boils his body in a large kettle to separate the bones. He wires the bones into a skeleton for instructional purposes, and then he takes the skin of Cato, the entire skin of the man, to the tanner, the leather tanner who served the college, and has it tanned so that he can use it to wrap his medical instrument case. Mm. His bag is actually wrapped in the skin of a Negro. We also know that at Harvard College, in 1763, there's a fire in Harvard Hall, which destroys, a fire burns Harvard Hall, and in the list of the things that were lost in the fire is included the jaw of a famous Indian chief. I believe that's Metacomet, King Philip, who the English call King Philip.
Yeah.
The famous King Philip of King Philip's War in 1675, but also the entire hide of a Negro, which had been tanned like leather for instructional purposes. And so, the rise of the sciences in the 18th century, the rise of medicine and the sciences in the 18th century, feeds upon the bodies of living and enslaved people living and dead enslaved people,
and
they become the material for the rise of the sciences.
So on this thing about the importance then of universities coming out with these scholars and training these scholars who then have these theories that fundamentally justify slavery by the inferiority of people of African descent. So tell us a little about that, because that was really an important role and perhaps even some of the purpose that they were so anxious to get the colleges going in the first place.
There was a perception that I had, actually, I think a lot of historians have, of the rise of racial science largely taking place in Europe and then expanding outward from there and being projected outward from there. And so in part, one of the things I had done was I went to some of the key centers for science instruction in the colonial world in the 18th century. And I looked at, I was researching the lecture notes of the professors, in part because I wanted to figure out how students in the 18th century learned race and what they were learning. And one of the things I noticed was actually that there was a lot less about race in many of these lectures than I thought there would be. But there was something else that was quite striking, which was the rise of a population of American-born colonial students in Europe. You know, by the 18th century, there are enough Virginians at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland to form a Virginia Club. And the students from the American colonies, from New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Barbados, are actually flooding into the best schools in Europe to study medicine and science. There's a race, actually, by the early 1760s between the New Yorkers and the Philadelphians to finish the medical program in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and then to get back to establish the first medical school in the colonies. The Philadelphians win, and the first medical college will be at the University of Pennsylvania. And it will begin in part when the colonial government transfers to the new medical faculty the body of a Negro, so that they can actually show the intellectual importance and power of dissection and anatomy through a public dissection. The next one will be established at King's College, which is now Columbia University in Manhattan, and again, you know, it's access to the bodies of enslaved people. But the other thing that I realized as I was sort of tracing the journeys of these students is that when young Americans actually arrived in Europe at these centers for the study of science, they often got transformed on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean into experts on race, because they actually were coming from places. Many of them are the, you know, are from slaveholding families, from plantations families in the Virginia, the Carolinas, and the West Indies. But the Northerners are also often from slaveholding families in places like New Jersey and New York. Many of them have intimate relationships with Africans and Native Americans, and they emerge in Europe as sort of experts on race, and particularly on the populations of people in the Americas. They're producing dissertations at times, for instance, on the course of disease among Native Americans. They're giving lectures on the frequency of certain kinds of conditions and diseases, and the impact of certain kinds of diseases on Native Americans and Africans, the difference between different populations of people and their resistance to diseases. They emerge as experts, and then when they get back to the Americas, a lot of that expertise, or at least that claim to expertise, become central to the project of establishing these new medical schools and science faculties, so that by the, you know, what the chapter that you talk about on the bodily and mental inferiority of the Negro is the title of the chapter. It looks at an early 19th century case, an 1808 case in New York City, in which the court calls upon the leading medical experts for testimony in what's a paternity case. And what's that question is the father of a child who's now being sought, the father's being sought out under a new York State law. And there's a possibility that it's Alexander Winslow, a black man, or an unnamed white man. And the court can't determine the paternity, and so what they do is they turn to a series of experts. They draw the experts from these new colleges, from the, you know, what's now Columbia, what's Columbia College's medical school, the College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York, the Rutgers University Medical School, which was then Queens College, and the College of Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania Medical School. And these experts actually now display the power of racial science as they attempt to determine the paternity of this child. But it's a remarkable moment for understanding both how fully, how quickly, and how decisively racial science emerges in the Americas and achieves a kind of legitimacy in the intellectual cultures of the Americas, and how important Americans are to that process.
Yeah, and very important in the post-slavery era with, you know, Jim Crow and even today, there's some of that still bantering around.
Yeah, no, there is.
There is. Yeah.
At every elite university in the United States, there's some version of this science.
Yeah.
Still being produced. Yeah.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder, and he has a book out entitled Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. I did want to you to say a bit, too, about the American Colonization Society.
The book ends, the honest ending of the book is in the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an epilogue that takes us a bit further up to the Civil War. But really, in fact, the primary part of the book, the real central arguments of the book, end in the 1830s. And there's a reason for that. The reason was that the 1830s is a period when I think the modern American university emerges. The university that we recognize today, the college that we recognize today, emerges roughly in the 1830s. The 1830s are the period when colleges throw off the final vestiges of their early relationship to churches. And we didn't talk about this, but you know, the earliest of the colleges, the colonial colleges, are denominational schools. So, you know, the College of Rhode Island, which is now Brown, is a Baptist college. The College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, is a Presbyterian college. Columbia is Anglican. And so the colleges are actually denominational schools. They throw off the final vestiges of their connection to the church by the 1830s. And they enter into a new moment in which they can occupy the public sphere independently, where they become important institutions in the public affairs of the United States, no longer subordinate to the church. And part of the path to that new political presence, to that new public presence and public role, is actually their expertise, over the claimed expertise, over questions like race and the appropriate makeup of the citizenry of the United States. And I look at this in a number of ways, and one of them is the overrepresentation of academics in movements like the colonizationist movement. The American Colonization Society is founded in 1817 with the purpose of removing free black people from the United States to some place outside the United States. In 1822, the Colonization Society establishes the Liberia colony on the African coast. And the Reverend Ralph Randolph Gurley, who's the principal agent of the society, invents the name Liberia for that colony. But the goal of the Colonization Society to remove the free black population runs parallel with a series of removal campaigns that actually define a whole generation of American history, a good 30-year period of American history. One has to understand colonization in dialogue with the campaign to remove for Indian removal, the 1830 Indian Removal Act, and the campaign to remove Native American nations from the southeastern seaboard states, sort of forced migration west of the Mississippi River, and movements like the Society for the Amelioration of the Condition of the Jews in New York, which is seeking to convert the Jewish population to Christianity or to fund their removal to some place outside the United States. When you put these movements together and you think about how attracted so many Americans were, we're talking about, you know, millions of people who were attracted to movements to racially and religiously homogenize the United States and create an all-white, all-Christian nation. One of the things that's stunning about this is that the logic beneath these movements was largely crafted on campus. It was the emergence of a kind of racial science and a definition of race that made the inclusion of other people unacceptable, because it made permanent the differences between human beings, immutable, unchangeable, and fixed. And it provided a rationale for projecting a future of the American nation in which progress almost seem to require racial homogeneity or a certain kind of ethnic cleansing in which people were simply removed from the society. Academics are, in fact, completely overrepresented in the American colonization society, about probably three-quarters of the campuses in the United States by the 1830s. Are actually have relationships to the American Colonization Society. At the height of its power, the president of the American Colonization Society is the former president of the United States, James Madison. His vice president is the president of Yale, the Reverend Jeremiah Day. And Reverend Day's status within the Colonization Society doesn't rest upon his status as a minister, which in the 18th century would have been, in fact, the reason why he entered into public affairs. A college president would enter into public affairs, like during the American Revolution. A lot of college presidents are actually actively engaged in the American cause. But typically, they're actually standing on their credentials as ministers, as representatives of church populations. By the 19th century, when Day is standing at the top of the American Colonization Society, he's standing on his status as an academic, as someone who has a claim to secular expertise and who has definitions of the future of the nation and a vision of the future of the nation, which is informed by an expertise that has been generated on campus and uses the unshakable claims of science as its foundation.
Well, Dr. Craig Stephen Wilder, professor of American history at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also has taught at Williams College and Dartmouth College, has a book out now, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's University, Ebony and Ivy. Sadly, we're out of time. I just can't believe it. Thank you for joining us.
It did go quickly.
We are out of time. I'd like to thank our guest, Professor Craig S. Wilder. Today's show was produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's 9 a.m. Next up, we have Beloved Community when John Shuck speaks with Chris Hedges about his book, America, The Farewell Tour.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO